Joe presents Baz and Andrew's House of Rugby, together with Guinness.
Hello, and you're very welcome to Baz and Andrew's House of Rugby here on Joe Together with Guinness. We have two episodes left on this year's House of Rugby before we take a break over July, and then we'll be back for season three in August. But to tie it up, what has been a really enjoyable season for us, producer Pat has come up with the lovely idea that we're going to turn the spotlight on each other for the next 2 weeks. So it'll be Trimby interviewing me next week about my career and all that crack. But this week, it is me interviewing and putting the spotlight and getting under the lid of Andrew Trimble this week.
It's all about you. It's all about you, Trimby. It's all about you. It's all about you. It's all about you.
Beautiful, beautiful start, Barry. You've set the bar extremely high.
For our listeners and viewers, obviously, that don't know, you were a massive busted Ormac Fly fan back in the day. So that's why I chose that song. It was my first introduction to you. I think we were at Irish Academy and you were like, we were chatting over lunch, and I can't remember which one it was. Which one did you use to design your look on? Was it busted or McFly? Because you had those like, the blonde hair that the guitarist had, and you had those checkered Vans shoes, you know, those slip-on Vans shoes.
And no, it was slightly later. No, it was the green Flash I had.
Green, yes.
The Dunlop green Flash.
Yeah. Yes, with the choker chain and your
and a chain. And a chain that went from my belt to my wallet in my back pocket.
All your little bracelets and all that crack.
Shark tooth necklace.
Yes, and it was all like, "Hey, well, my teacher is really sexy. I really fancy my teacher." Something like that, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was. It was. You don't need to differentiate between Busted and McFly. Didn't they hybrid? Didn't they become McBusted?
Oh, they did.
They did.
Yeah. I knew there was something in my head about that. Yes. Yeah. Sorry. So that was that hard day for you, or? Was that a good day?
That was a good day. That was lovely because it just meant you didn't need to give it any more thought. There was no more confusion.
You had been like a very religious man. Was that like the Catholic and Protestant church coming together to make one beautiful religion? Was it the same thing?
I suppose. Although maybe the McFly and Busted brands were more aligned than the Catholic and Protestant brands.
You never know.
It was an easier acquisition.
Maybe they could lead it. Like it could be McFly and Busted that could lead the way for the Catholic and Protestant church.
Yeah, yeah. Just you get some of that cardinal standing up to make a speech. Lads, if McFly and Busted can do it, we can do it.
Have you been to the year 3000? And then just change all the lyrics so it fits with like the Catholic Church and the Protestant Church. So yeah. La, 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 la.
I got abused. You're talking about that kind of that look whenever I was a youngster. I got abused. Me and Anna went to a comedy night in New York one time, and this guy spent about 5 minutes abusing me for looking like a surfer dude in the back.
But it wasn't quite surfer dude. It was like street surf. It was those lads from Busted and McFly had never been to a surfboard in their lives.
Yeah, but there was that influence. Remember, remember you said about Jack Johnson? That really stuck with me. Jack Johnson and everybody then was in board shorts for a while and flip-flops and trying to do that kind of surf-free thing. Remember we went on tour to South Africa whenever I was in school, and all anybody ever did, they all just went to the Billabong shop in South Africa, in George or Cape Town, wherever it was. That was the thing. Like that was the look. That was the popular look back then.
It was. You're very right. Well, okay. Take me back. Take me back to that time, because Pat sent me on an extract from Stephen Ferris's book last night, which he had a little part about you and when he first heard your name and the murmurings of your name when you played for Coleraine, and he was going playing you in a school's cup match, expecting to be absolutely hosed because Andrew Trimble, this guy that no one had ever seen, but they just heard of, was playing. And
No one had ever. So if you went to Korean and you listened in the wind, you could just hear Andrew Trimble.
you're like the Loch Ness monster, just this big long arm coming out of the water. they said they started the game and they went 5 points up. He stuck in where he scored a 50 meter try.
I read Ferris's book and I don't remember this.
You don't remember? He said you scored four tries and you ran riot. And then he'd also heard that you were a really nice fella. But when you were scoring your fourth try, he was trying to stop you from getting under the posts. So he went to kind of block you and you just slammed the ball down and then busted him with a shoulder, put him back in his arse, and then looked back at him and snarled and ran off. And he was like, Jesus. Andrew Trimble is the real... He also called you the Terminator, which I thought was so fitting because that's kind of what you played like. Very straight, like very, very big and strong and fast. Very little emotion on your face. Just like, ah. And so was that you in school? There was always that one guy who was coming out of school's rugby, whether it was in every province, I think, had one that was going to be the next big thing. And I think you were that guy in Ulster.
Maybe. In Upper Sixth, I took a wee while to mature. It took me until I was maybe kind of lower sixth to kind of kick on and actually, because I had always had long arms. And believe it or not, I've actually grown into those arms.
Yeah. Jeez, I can't imagine what they were like before.
So then by the time I got to Upper Sixth, I kind of started doing well. I don't want to give myself too much credit. Like, we were playing Friends, and Friends nowadays are quite good, but Friends back then were rubbish. And it was in the subsidiary.
Friends, is that the name of a school?
Yeah, Friends, a school in Lisburn. So that's where Ferris went. But he came through.
Friends. We're playing Friends today, lads. It doesn't really strike fear into the heart, does it? Friends.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that was our initial reaction to the name of the school whenever you discover it. But then it becomes very normal. And then you realize actually, or you kind of forget that's people's initial reaction. But okay. He came through the club scene. He played for Portadown. So that kind of shows you where Friends were at. They were a grammar school, but they weren't very good. We played them in the subsidiary shield or like the knock, you know, when you get knocked out in the first round. So they were like, and it was, they'd obviously been beaten the first round. We got beat by Methley, I think it was. And like, it was a reasonably close game. So we were okay. And we went on to win the subsidiary shield. So scoring four tries against Friends was no big deal at all. They were crap.
Okay.
And Ferris, I don't remember that incident, but I thought the way Ferris described it to me was that I was trying to get underneath the posts and he tried to stop me. And before I put the ball down, I fended him. I handed him.
Before you put it down.
Before I put it down. That's what he described to me. Again, I don't even remember that. But I probably
and then just went busted.
But yeah, McFly. You just got McFly. It's not a massive stretch that I might have done that because I think I might have maybe tried to show off a little bit.
Really?
Maybe I just would have.
Cause for that year, you were like, so were you, did you physically develop massively in those last 2 years of school like that made you jump that, to that level?
It was all physical
that
development.
From weights?
Yeah, just weights and just did loads of speed session, loads of running and...
In school with a coach or on your own?
Mostly on my own. Phil Morrow came down and actually did a little bit of work with us. He was the academy coach at the time, so he would have given us a bit of direction. And then there was a few of us, me and two other guys, actually not rugby guys, the whole summer before. Then we all started going to the gym, you know, and doing all these like circuits together and stuff. And then we all bought singlets.
Of course, because, you did.
We're on the bench press machine, you know.
Yeah.
Thinking everybody's looking over, going, "Those guys are on this."
Wow, God, yeah. I hate young fellas like that in the gym now. I'm like, God, they're still there. Like, I'm like, shut up.
So yeah, that was us.
All with their headphones on, together in the gym, but all wearing headphones.
That's bizarre.
Not chatting to each other. Just like if I go to the gym, I'm mostly there for the chats. I'm not there to fucking shape. Like, yeah, I remember, because my first memory of you was, so that must have been March, let's say, for schools. That June, we played, I was going to the World Cup with Ireland under 21s, and we played an Ulster A team in a warm-up. Do you remember where that was? Was it Enniskillen or something like that?
Enniskillen. I think they were opening the new pitch in Enniskillen. So this was the big.
So we played, Gene, it was our last warm-up game. So everyone was going out to prove that they were good enough to start. We'd South Africa in the first round the following week. And it was a good side he had out. I think David Humphreys was playing. Johnny Bell might have been playing.
Yeah.
But then the chat beforehand was that there was an Andrew Trimble, this guy from school, was playing 13. And he's supposed to be a freak. And I was like, fuck, I'm playing 13.
I'm not a freak.
So I was thinking, like, if you were the Terminator, I was more like John Connor from Terminator. I was like quite skinny and feeble, but I was quite snaky in my ways, and I would have like robbing ATMs with a pair of trouser braces or something like that. I was
you're the guy in Terminator 2 that is delivering the rose. And Schwarzenegger grabs him and uses him as a shield, like Nelson Muntz. You're that guy.
Yeah. So, but I got the better of you in the opening 20 minutes, where I made a muppet of you.
Because you were
young, and all you wanted to do is just up and in and smash people. And I could see that. So I remember clearly. But like, I don't remember in my life meeting or seeing too many people. But I'll never forget that day I met you. For the first time, I didn't even meet you, but I played against you because you absolutely lamped me with a handoff in the second half and got me back for me embarrassing you in the first half by running a try in against you. And I felt, wow, this guy's the real deal. And it was the physical. You were massive, like for a 13 to be that size at that age. It was fairly impressive.
I was very nervous. Now I was so excited. I was playing with David Humphreys and Johnny Bell as well. But David Humphreys was my hero growing up, and getting the chance to play with him. And then I remember you going past me. You just kind of ghosted past me the first time you got the ball. And I just remember thinking, I've got a lot to learn. And then Johnny Bell, it was handy for him. If I had been a little bit more streetwise, I might have been able to kind of put the blame onto him a little bit, or maybe not give me enough talk, but he was certainly not going to be outsmarted by an 18-year-old kid. So yeah, I got the blame for that. That kind of made me realize I had a lot to learn, so I had to kind of go back and look at a lot of stuff. But yeah, that's funny, isn't it, us coming across each other the first time.
It was weird, and I remember it very, you know, very vividly. So you left a mark, and you were very serious. I remember that. And you kind of looked quite serious and focused for a lot of your career. And having gotten to know you throughout your career, I knew you weren't that serious a person, quite the opposite off the pitch. So when you look back as a kid, like, what were you like as a kid? Were you quite a serious young fella? You know, how did your parents drive the focus side, the sports side? Or what was it like for you growing up?
I don't think I was that. I know that I even watching back footage, I do think I look like quite focused, but I think at the time it was just nervousness. I was very
sorry. I thought that as well this morning. I was looking at your try highlights, and I was like, look, he doesn't smile. Look how serious he is. And then I was like, you know what? I think he's just like, kind of like nervous and
just don't know what to do. And we spoke about this before. I look back and regret that I didn't kind of relax more, enjoy it more, enjoy the occasion more. And I was enjoying it just in my own way, but I was always very self-conscious and wanted to fit in, I don't know, just not look odd or something. Then you're always
to do the right thing.
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. So when you score a try, it's like do the hand clap and then back to the halfway line as quickly as possible.
Yeah.
There's no bit of a laugh, or I was the exact same. And I think it was very much that era. It was you'd wear it like a badge of honor, right?
Yeah. I remember you after the try against Seal, you just came straight back. You were poker face as well. And I remember James Topping said to me one time, geez, you're like Tyrone Howe used to score a try and like he'd be sprinting back into his own half to receive the kickoff faster than he was sprinting to score the try. he was always the first guy back over his line. And Topping said to me, you're a bit like that. But it's just, I don't know, you just feel like, oh, how do I behave here?
You'd seen someone else do it. And like, because yeah. I remember Federico Puttarello probably scored one try for Munster. And I never laughed so much because when he scored it, he sprinted back to the halfway line. And like, yeah. normally he'd be the last fella traipsing back over the halfway line for the kickoff, like getting as much of a breath as he could. So I know what you mean. But what, so as a kid though, take me back, what was it like for you? Growing up, were your parents driving you towards sport or what was it?
No, my dad obviously, you know, loved his rugby and he had a rugby background. So he kind of made sure that I got a bit of exposure to that. And I loved it. I loved the rough and tumble. I loved the physical side of it. Always did. I saw a picture. My mom keeps all these kind of photo albums and kind of scrapbooks, and there was one of me when I was playing mini rugby and I'm taking the head off some poor fella and highly illegal, it's a red card these days, I've got this guy like by the collar, just a complete clothesline. I was, what would I have been, like 9, 10, so I just enjoyed kind of the rough and tumble and the physical side of it.
Would anyone say that's, oh, you're like your dad the way you do that, or your mother would be like that, or what? Or your sisters?
My dad would have been physical, and then back then whenever he played, then it would have been like, I think he would have been known for being a little bit of a dirty player. I wouldn't have been a dirty player, but I've been pretty physical, and there would be the amount of people that would say this exact line. People would say, I played against your dad, and they would go, and I've got the scars to prove it.
No way. Wow. What position was he?
All over the pack. I think he played mostly second row and back row.
Wow.
Back then, like second row, he was playing the second row and he's only 6 foot. But back then that was big. But yeah, he would have been, I think he would have been reasonably physical. Him and his brother, the two of them. Okay. Haven't heard from Uncle Philip now so much since they retired.
You're a huge disappointment to him now.
Yeah, exactly. What? You're doing some podcast with Barry?
Who?
My mom loved tennis, so I played a bit of tennis. That was her influence, and played a bit of rugby, and then rugby kind of won out, and I just loved it. I loved the crack, I loved the boys, I loved the physical side of it. And then whenever I started getting like a bit better, whenever I was kind of lower sixth, upper sixth, whenever I kind of filled my frame a little bit, then I was like, it's just so much fun to be good at this. You know?
Yeah, I know what you mean. Yeah. And but what about like school, throughout school, was there any other ambitions you'd have had, or was it always, did you kind of think professional sport was something you'd always get into, or what else had you in mind?
I didn't know how accessible, I didn't know how realistic playing rugby professionally would have been, because it's a bubble, you know. You grow up in your home kind of school and you never really think of anything kind of outside that, and I never really knew how, not how easy, but how accessible it would be, how realistic it would be to become a professional and to kick on, to play for Ulster and play for Ireland. I always wanted to play for Ulster and play for Ireland. And then that all the way through, even whenever I was at uni, and I had a bit of a lull after. So remember what you described there, that kind of me getting rounded by you and playing that first game. And then I realized, right, I've got a lot to learn here. That following year, then I did learn a lot. I didn't get involved with under 21s. Mark McCall was coaching at the time, and defensively I got caught out a little bit. So physically I was going well, but I had loads to learn. Skills were poor. Defensive reading of the game was poor. So I had a lot to learn. And that wee lull was a real downer for me, because I was thinking all I wanted was the kid. All I wanted to do was be a professional rugby player at that stage. And I was studying, you know, at Queen's or whatever, but I didn't see myself do anything else apart from become a professional and doing rugby full time. And because I had that lull, then it looked a little bit less likely that I might be able to do that. So I found that kind of wee stage a bit tricky, and then kind of caught up a little bit and started doing well again.
Okay. And what were you studying?
Physics.
Physics.
I studied physics. Yeah.
Wow. I didn't even think you could do sums, man. You hide it well, don't you?
Yeah. I was good at maths and sciences in school, and then I just didn't know. I didn't care what I did. I just wanted to play rugby. So then my mom and dad suggested, you're okay at physics, so why don't you just do physics? And then it keeps things open-ended. And then so I did physics for a year, and there was a few maths modules and stuff as well, and it was miserable. I just could not be bothered. I was having the crack at uni with the boys I lived with, having the time of my life. It was brilliant. I was loving it, and I just hardly ever went to class. And then eventually I just changed. Well, I say changed. I dropped out and then did theology instead. And I just did that part-time for like 7 years. I think I got the record at Queen's for like the longest undergrad anyone's ever done.
Go away.
Yeah.
Van Wilder. Mm. So was that when you first got into faith and spirituality, or was that something like when you went to college, or was that something you'd had when you were younger?
No, that was something I had when I was younger. Always like kind of grew up going to church. And then when I was kind of 15, 16, in around there, I started taking that a little bit more seriously, and then kind of brought that with me to uni.
What church is it? I never asked you that, actually.
A bit of everything, to be honest. Like I grew up in a Church of Ireland, and then I went to Presbyterian Church whenever I was a teenager, and then we got married out of a Baptist church. The church we were going to up here was actually non-denominational. So it's anyway, it doesn't really.
So was that your drive? You driving that, like changing what church you went to, or your parents, or what?
No. I didn't. It wasn't that we were unhappy with one. We moved to another. It was just it didn't really matter to me. The differences between those churches were so small that I didn't really care.
How has that changed, I suppose, from when you were a kid to throughout your teenage years to playing years, and now as you retired and with kids yourself?
Yeah, I suppose whenever you're 19 and you go to university and you've got all these like strong opinions and everything's very black and white and you can tidy everything away into little boxes. Mm-hmm. University kind of like, people kind of rediscover themselves and think, right, I'm going to stand for this, I'm going to stand for that.
Yeah.
I'm not saying that was me, but there was an element of that. You know, I was probably a bit of a smart arse, I think. And I thought I had
it's a hotbed for extremism, really, university, isn't it?
Yeah.
Like you get all these people channeled who are breaking free from being in a structured school environment and family environment. And then it's like, you'd be free, but at the same time, you're like, freedom, but you just want to go, I just want to be a part of something.
You want an identity. Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm not making that sound trivial. Like it was a sincere faith, but how that then manifested itself in kind of relationships and how I communicated that faith was pretty black and white. And I believe this, and I believe that, and I believe this is the consequence of that. And, you know, this is what's important to believe, you know. And I think, as then you grow up a little bit and then you kind of just have more life experience, then you start to realize not everything's black and white. There's a lot of gray areas in there. And then, as you say, you get married, you have kids, then you kind of finish off one career and you spend a lot of time, you know, traveling, touring, spending time with people from different environments, different backgrounds. And then you kind of realize, this is a lot more complicated than the kind of black and white university 19-year-old myself. Yeah. So I think that's just maturing and kind of growing up a little bit and appreciating a wider worldview, maybe.
Okay. So did you, like, because there was an element of like, he's a bit strange, that fella. He's carrying around a Bible and
man with the long arms is a bit strange, isn't he?
He's a weirdo. But there was an element of like, lads, you know, it's at that age as well, you're getting, everyone's like, you're going into these academies and it's a hotbed of people like panicking and trying to, and there's a bit of bullying going on, and there's a bit of bravado, and I would have always heard lads saying, he's a fucking weirdo, he's carrying around a Bible and he's reading it in the dress room and stuff. Whereas clearly you weren't, like, you were an unbelievable laugh as far as I can remember. So it wasn't, but so I thought that was very strange. But how did that feel for you? Kind of, you must have been aware of that to some degree.
Yeah, it was. Yeah, it was important to me to kind of maintain that, you know, what I was presenting. So it didn't bother me either. I just assumed everybody gets slagged for something. So
right, yeah,
it may as well be that. If it's not that, they'll find something else. That's the beauty of that kind of rugby team environment. Everybody gets abused. Every single person in every team gets a hard time.
So you probably picked up, you said, I'm going to go extra hard with religion now, just so they focus on that and don't...
please don't notice my long arms, please.
Carrying around the Bible upside down, like Trump reading the upside down Bible.
It's important, you know. My kind of faith, you know, growing up was very important. But I suppose in hindsight, I wish I'd maybe just allowed myself to be. I wasn't quite myself, I don't think, with a lot of people. I would have been quite reserved, would have been quite concerned about maybe putting out something out there that wasn't consistent with what I was saying. So there was a lot of that kind of shaped the way I behaved, which it's just kind of reasonably normal enough, I suppose, if you grew up with that upbringing, you know. I think just as you grow up, you have a more life experience, and then you start to just really genuinely enjoy that environment, feel more comfortable in that environment. I know we talked about having Phil Morrow on the show, but so he was, you know what, that role as an S&C is kind of a little bit of a one-on-one role, a bit of a mentoring role. And he was so good for me coming into the Ulster or the Ireland Academy, it was back then, in Ulster Development. He kind of just took me under his wing and gave me a nickname and brought me in with the boys and kind of slagged me and stuff and kind of give, you know, just that was a nice way. And I felt more comfortable with him. Then I came out of my shell a bit more. But I remember, like, you get young guys coming into the Ulster squads whenever I was a senior player there. Young guys would come in, they would straight away like introduce themselves, how's things, how you getting on? And they're so outgoing, so chatty and so confident. I can't get my head around that. I didn't say a thing to anyone for at least 12 months. Bryn Cunningham and Phil Morrow were the two guys I spoke to. David Humphreys a little bit as well, but like that took a lot. I had to dig deep to get the confidence to speak to Humphreys.
Really?
But yeah, like as a young fella coming in, these were my heroes, and I was nervous, I was shy. It took me a while to find my feet.
Yeah, I think that it kind of goes with the territory. I think a lot of the lads would have, like Anthony Foley would have almost expected that from the guys that were going to make it. He'd go, I remember thinking, box smart here to myself, like, don't go in there and start talking to these guys. You have to earn it. And remember looking at guys who didn't really do that and who went the opposite way and were loud and expressed themselves. And I think it went against them at that time, which is pretty silly in hindsight. That would go against just someone being themselves, and you're judging them as a rugby player with that. But it was definitely something that went on back then, and it stopped me from developing, to be honest with you, until, you know, I regressed a little bit after 21s, because I went into that environment, the professional rugby, and I was bottom of the pecking order. I was like, I can't go in and put my stamp on this. I think physically I wasn't developed, so it stopped me from putting a stamp in there. But you, obviously, at 19, maybe 20, was it when you might have been a bit shy, but physically you could mix it with all the best in Ulster and at Irish camp. So you kind of fast-tracked through at that time as well.
Yeah, yeah. And any time there was any contact in sessions for Ulster, it was a good opportunity for me to shine. I remember we signed Kevin Maggs, and it was pre-season. We were doing pre-season in Scotland. Must have been 2000 and might have been 2004. Anyway, might have been 2005. Mm. Doesn't matter. So we can't sign Kevin Maggs, and I went after him. He like took a ball out the back, and I kind of shot to try and make a hit on him, and I just bounced off him. He was so I kind of got it carried away, and yeah, I just thought, right, I can kind of physically do really well here and be pretty confrontational. And that was the one time I was like, I've got a lot to learn.
Yeah.
And I need to like stop going after massive ball carrying 12s.
yeah.
But yeah, it was more generally, I felt pretty good in those kind of sessions. They were a good opportunity for me to show that I was able to mix it a little bit.
Yeah. And then what's your earliest memory of breaking through and getting your first game for Ulster, and how quickly did that turn into your first Irish camp?
Really quickly. So we played, I played in the wing against Cardiff, and then it ramped up really quickly, and then maybe two or three Magners League games, and then it was into Europe. And I played, I think maybe definitely the first little block of two, Biarritz away. That might have been the first game. Don't know, might have been the first game, might have been the second game, but I went really well in that game.
What was the back line for you that you had that then?
Oh, you put me on the spot. It would have been maybe Kieran Campbell, but Isaac Boss had just signed. I think I remember Isaac Boss came to Biarritz actually, but he was just to get him involved in the team a little bit, or in the squad a little bit. Then eventually, as the season went on, Isaac took Kieran's place. David Humphreys, Paul Steinmetz, I was at 13. Tommy, I assume, was on the right. Might have been Andrew Maxwell on the left, and then Bryn Cunningham at fullback.
Nice.
I think Pat will probably be able to check how accurate that was. But we went quite well, actually, and I made a couple of carries and a few gain lines and a little bit of a bust. I did quite well. And then the president of Biarritz, after the game, he said, it wasn't Serge Betson. Serge Blanco. It wasn't him. He was the president, actually. It was, I don't know who it was. Probably some randomer taking the piss out of me. This guy goes, you come to Biarritz and you play rugby in the sunshine. And I was there, oh, that sounds great. Sliding doors. Imagine I'd gone to Biarritz whenever I was 21-year-old.
Wow. You'd have fitted in well, man, to be fair. The flow, like, especially when you grew that flowing blonde hair. For a short period, I could imagine it.
That was similar to the O'Driscoll long kind of bleach blonde hair, wasn't it? Only I didn't have the gloves, no gloves. then after that, it was autumn camp, and then I managed to get my first game against Romania. So
that was your first cap?
Yeah, Romania.
Mm-hmm. Romania. You scored a couple of tries.
That's right, what am I saying? No, Romania was the second cap. Australia was the first cap. Scored a couple tries against Romania. Yeah, sorry.
Yeah. So you started against Australia?
Yes, yeah.
Wow. Was that when Dricko was injured?
Yes, that's right.
So you started 13 with Darce, and Rog would have been 10, would he, or Humps would have been 10?
Rog was 10. Humph came off the bench.
Wow. That's class, man. Like, you'd have been watching him since you were 13, 14, and then... at least, and then playing with him for Ireland in your first cap.
Yeah, Humph took me aside. Rod just always slagged Humph, me and Tommy, because Humph would have took me and Tommy out. He was driving an M3 at the time, and he would have been revving up the driveway up to City West Hotel and all. You're kind of showing off, you know, a little bit to the young fellas. He took us under his wing a little bit. And then Rog was like, well, where's Daddy and the two kids going today?
Brilliant.
So Humph was very good to us, you know, kind of just took us under his wing, looked after us a bit. And remember Humph saying just before that first game, he said, just try not to be overawed with the occasion, and just at some stage, just make sure and look around the old Lansdowne Road, packed to the rafters, just have a look around and just drink it in and enjoy it and try and be in the moment. And I was like, what a great piece of advice. And I remember actually a break and play, looking around thinking, this is incredible. I was just, dream come true. It was amazing.
Yeah, I think that's such a good bit of advice. Whether it helps you in the game or not, Who knows? But the fact that you can look back and that you actually did that and took it all in, I think is more important than whatever moment you would have had in the game if you were laser focused or whatever. But
yeah,
to be fair, it's about that moment, especially in the old Lansdowne Road, because it had so much history there. I think there's a you'd be very lucky to have played in big games for Ireland there.
Who came over? So Takiri came over. He was then 13. He came over and gave me his jersey, and I went to give him my jersey, and he said, no, first test, don't worry about it. Give me his jersey. And then Latham, the fullback, Latham came over and said, oh, first test, congratulations. Real friendly, real nice fellas. It was...
Wow.
Yeah, it really added to it. It was a nice touch.
That's brilliant. Love the Latham, man. He was one of my favourite players. So you're beaten. What was it, 30-14 or something like that? I remember looking at it last night. But pretty tight game. And then... Romania the following week, you got a bit more of a foothold, 2 tries. And I think that was your first. Everyone was like, Jesus, this guy's impressive. And it was the first, for me, bit of a freak in the Irish backline in terms of size and strength. And you felt like, you looked like you were at home.
Yeah, felt at home. Felt good. Although scoring a couple of tries against Romania is like scoring 4 tries against France.
Sorry, yeah, I picked that up way too much.
Yeah, massively. It was great. It was we kind of just ran amok, and it was an all right. It wasn't a great game, as games against Romania are rarely good. But it was fine. I remember again, we were talking earlier on there about the self consciousness about, you know, whenever you feel like everybody's looking at you. After I scored the only try I can remember scoring in that game. I got up, and you'll never see someone look more sheepish. Like my housemates at the time were just like, why are you acting so weird? I just got up and I looked like Father Dougal. Just didn't know.
You do resemble him a lot, man, to be honest with you. He's always on the tip of my tongue when you do something like that.
Yeah.
And then the Six Nations that followed. Drico was back for that, right?
Drico was back, yeah. So then I was on the bench. And I think I was on the bench for the first game, the opening game away to France.
Came on and scored, right? Yeah,
Tommy was on the right. And this is famously whenever Tommy got a 0 out of 10 from Neil Francis.
Yeah.
Because we were operating a blitz defense, and it was quite new to the game then. So... Tommy slipped, actually. I don't think it was a defensive issue or a decision making issue. He slipped. He slipped 0. That's so unfair.
It's so harsh in that. I've watched a few games back over the last few years of my games back in around that. Must have been 2006, 2007, and we started bringing in that defense as well. And I'm watching it now, going, "What are you doing? Yeah. What are you doing?" And I get away with it the odd time, but it looks insane watching it back. It's mad how rugby goes through those crazy trends.
Yeah.
But you came on. I remember coming on that French match and you getting a try. And what did the rest of the Six Nations pan out for you that year? What was it like?
I think we won the Triple Crown that year. That was the year whenever we went to Twickenham and Shaggy got the reach, like that kind of famous try. Then I think I started against Wales in between those two before we end up in Twickenham. So I came off the bench against France. We were getting a hiding. Heymans, Clerc, Jougeon were running amok. They were incredible that day. Unbelievably good. And then they just got to 50 minutes and they were like, c'est le bleu, c'est la vie. Stop it. We're not that bothered anymore. And then that kind of gave us an opportunity to get back into it a little bit, and we did. I came off the bench and scored one. We scored a couple more tries, but we were never really catching them. So then I started the next week. So I was rooming with Tommy, and it was a little bit awkward when we got back to the hotel because I was obviously delighted with my contribution because I got the last 20 minutes when we were doing well, and then Tommy was hating his life. I think that was the time whenever I was in the bench and I came out and sat on the bench for 20 minutes and then realized I didn't have my jersey on. And like that moment where you forget your boots, and I looked at it, I was like, oh no, if he calls me, I like sprinted down the tunnel, got my jersey on, just came back thinking, you're an absolute dope. Like, what? It's your first Six Nations game and you forgot to put your jersey on. Stupid.
Soaking it all up. Soak it up, Andrew. Don't forget to soak it up when you walk out.
You were talking about top on. So you're talking about how you could potentially interpret the way I behaved as being laser focused. I had no top on. How laser focused is that?
Oh, there's nothing worse than those moments, man, when you're when you just you forget something like your boots or your gum shield or
So obviously I had my tracksuit top on or my bib on over or something, so it was kind of disguised. Didn't realize until I looked in. So stupid.
And come here, what about your relationship with Tommy throughout all of that? Because you were competing for position for a lot of your career, I suppose. And then you were always good friends from what I could see. Was that ever awkward or how did that pan out? Was it?
Honestly, rarely awkward. We fell out a few times on the pitch. Actually, on the pitch, we didn't really fall out. We never really fell out like off the pitch, but on the pitch, we had to go with each other a good few times, actually. There was one time in particular, I remember we were playing a home game, a league game at Ravenhill. And I was a little bit, I certainly wasn't laser focused. I was a little bit apathetic, kind of just cruised onto the pitch, didn't really think about it too much. And we kicked the ball down the right-hand side and I kind of sauntered after it, not really too switched on or not too intentional. And Tommy spotted this. And Tommy was like, would you get your head out of your arse from being right? And then I was kind of flustered. So and my reply was, it is out of its arse. and then I looked at him and we both just laughed. And I was like, I'm so sorry. That's the stupidest comeback you'll ever hear in your life. Okay. And to be fair, Tommy was spot on. And I played really, I don't remember who we were playing that game, but I remember him saying to me afterwards, how well did you play after I told you to get your head out of ours? That's the best piece of advice anyone's ever given anyone on a rugby pitch.
Yeah. I remember O'Connell giving me one of them down in Cork, similar game, like, will you run, Baz? And I never ran so fast in my life. Because, I was away with the fairies. We might have been beating the dragons quite well or something like that. But it was quite terrifying. Come here. We've gotten yourself up to, I suppose, starting with us, to starting with Ireland. And before we go any further, I'd like to get a fellow Ulster and Ireland player who would have, I think you're a week older than him or vice versa. Chris Henry is going to join us on the show now and talk us through his memories of playing with Trimby for Ulster and Ireland.
Tanas makes the tackle. Murray, there is a space here for Conor Murray. And Andrew Trimble is in. Ireland's second try. Two in rapid succession.
Okay, welcome back to part two of Walking Down Memory Lane with Andrew Trimble. And who better to get on the show to talk us through his Ulster and Ireland career than a guy that came up through the Ulster ranks with him, played for Ireland with him, was born 3 days before him in 1984 in Belfast, Mr. Chris Henry.
Hello, guys. Great, thanks. Yeah, thanks for having me on to your show, Barry. It's great to have No, Andrew thinks his show, but it's great to be on your show.
Thank you very much, Chris. I agree.
Chris, this better be good. I must say I'm actually quite nervous about what you're going to say, but we're getting O'Connell on next week to talk about Barry, so this needs to be very good.
Wow. Yeah. I can't see. I think I might have a few different types of stories than what Paul will have about Barry, maybe. But
he won't hold back, so don't hold back, basically.
Okay. Try not to.
So come here, you're born 3 days before Andrew Trimble, but when was the first time do you remember ever hearing or playing against him?
So the first time I ever remember Andrew was playing at Malone Minis against Colrian Minis. We would have been about maybe 12 years old or maybe younger even, Andrew, what do you reckon, 10? And
is this the one where I nearly killed you? Or
yeah, so basically my rugby career was nearly finished as a child because Andrew Trimble tackled me about 6 seconds late at a mini rugby game. And it was the first time where literally I've seen fans, like parents, all the kids, big ruckus at the side of the pitch because it was so blatant. He spear tackled me, lifted me up and dumped me down. And that's where the first time we saw the sort of the really nasty, angry side of Andrew. We were probably winning because we would always win those mini rugby games against him. And yeah, it was pretty vicious. And luckily I got up and played on, but pretty filthy.
Yeah, it was a game of, I think it was tens. You were pretty accustomed to sevens. Do you know they used to call Chris Hamburger Cerevi? Barry, do you know that?
Andrew, this is about you. This is not about me. I was promised when I came on, I said, right, I'll say no promise, but the promise that only goes to Andrew, not coming back at me.
I'm here for both, lads.
It might have been the final. I think it might have been the final. And you were cruising. To be fair, Chris is incredible at sevens, give him a bit of space. So tens, obviously a little bit less space, but he was cruising down the wing, a bit of a 2-on-1. And I knew they were definitely going to score. So I was like, I'm taking this fat kid out. I don't care. So I just emptied him. And all hell broke loose. There were parents running on, spectators, refs, everything. Everybody was going bananas. I can't remember if this was probably in an era before yellow cards or red cards. I don't know, Chad.
Yeah, no, 100%. This was like we were very, very young. So Andrew started rugby in Coleraine and I started Malone. So there was always big rivalry there. But no, there was definitely no yellow cards. But we won the game. And funny, Andrew, you mentioned Chad Cerevi, the nicknames. But Andrew's the only person I've ever known who's tried to start his own nickname. And it's actually worked. So he, for some reason, he thought that the dragon, you know what the dragon, where I know.
No, never.
Obviously, he must have had quite a lot of horrible nicknames growing up through school, but he decided, okay, I'll come into Ulster, new environment, nobody knows me. I'm going to start like telling people my nickname is Dragon. And that's just the more I say it, the more people jump on it, it'll stick. And that's what he's done. Until this day, a lot of people still know him as the Dragon. And it only happened because he forced the issue so much.
Yeah, so I touched on this a little bit earlier on. So Phil Morrow kind of helped me escalate that nickname a little bit. It started off before that, though, in school, in Upper Sicton School. You know, there was those area trials for Ulster schools before you go on to the big trial. And in that area one, then it was only me and one other fella, David Burns. I don't know if you remember him from school, Chad. And we were like, we're just a small country school. Playing against the bigger schools, we need to kind of make a name for ourselves. So Burnsy just took one of the other guys on my team aside and he goes, listen, just give the ball to Dragon, would you?
Oh my God. So
like, do you know when Friends, whenever Joey tries to make up a cool work nickname and he calls himself the Dragon?
And, is that where you got it from? You stole it from Friends?
That's where you got it from, yeah.
Oh, God, I thought that couldn't get any lamer, but it just did.
Friends is a reputable, that's a reputable source.
Oh, I don't
know. Dodgy episodes now, yeah.
Yeah, so that's where that came from.
But no, we've gone back a long time, Trimby. And then luckily, we played against each other for a long time through schoolboy. And then with Ulster schools and Irish schools, my other favourite story when we're talking about back in those days was that our Irish 21s, the whole lead up to the World Cup, we played in Argentina with a cracking 21s team. You know, you guys like, Kevin McLaughlin, Gareth Steenson, really, really talented group. And it was all about the power of the team, the power of the pack, the Wolf Pack and all this. But then literally as soon as we got over to Argentina playing those matches, every night, literally before the game, the team talk was completely changed. It was just literally the team talk was get the ball to Trimble. And that was us. So it didn't really matter about anything else. It was, I think you were playing 13 at that stage, which because they hadn't discovered you couldn't pass yet. So 13, and we literally just had to get the ball to Trimby, and Trimby would score. And to be fair, we won a lot of games that we shouldn't have by letting him crash ball and run through, and it took a lot of people to stop him in those days. That was always a funny memory about our 21s.
Really? So you did take the piss at 21s, Trimby. You were that kind of a freak of a player.
No, not especially. I was just slightly better than all the other wow. lads. We weren't great, to be fair, Chad.
You were bigger and faster. You were bigger.
How
and faster.
Did you? How did you do? How far did you get in the World Cup?
We came ninth, I think, wasn't it? It was ninth. We had Ryan Pienaar in the South Africa team beat us in the important game, but that was tough tournament. But no, I still remember, Andrew, you were bigger and you were faster than everybody.
yeah, but you're right. I hadn't learned. I had no idea of the subtleties of the game, how to pass, how to defend correctly, how to read the game. None of that.
It was. You were really good in the gym. That's what I remember around that time. Was that the same for you? For you, Chris, when it came to Ulster, was it just Andrew Trimble can do X amount of chin ups and that makes him a class player?
Yeah, pretty much. I think everyone just saw him in the gym. He'd wear his tight t-shirts, and that would be him. Because, geez, we must play this guy. He's in good shape. I used to be so jealous. We used to be up at Jordanstown. That's where what used to be in the academy at the Sports Institute. So we used to drive up there, you know, really early morning sessions. And a lot of us were really dedicated at that stage, working hard. Andrew used to just rock in, clean 100 kgs as a boy, no problems. He had power and that aggression. And his career moved off really, really quickly. I think Andrew,
he could do 20 chins. That's why, I think, was it? That's what they... I remember coming into where was that place in Dublin where we used to train the Institute of Sport?
Santry, no? Was
yeah.
it Santry?
Santry.
Yeah.
Going up to Santry with the Irish Academy, and it was a chin-up, a flexibility and a bench press test, basically. That's what we were being tested on. And I remember Trimby rocks up and does like 25 chin-ups. And I went up after and I just hung out of the bar.
But 25 chin-ups for us, Barry, is a lot. But you think of Andrew's length of Andrew's arms as well. So Andrew has ridiculously long arms. So that's, it's even tougher for him. So
yeah, my arms are so long. Most people have to bend at the knees so their feet don't hit the ground. I have to bend at the hips, bring my legs up straight, just chin-up like that because my arms are so long.
And come here, when then, Chris, do you reckon that people realise he couldn't pass and that his career kind of maybe slowed down for a while? Can you remember that moment?
I think you were chucked out the wing very quickly. Do you remember the year, Trimby?
Yeah, I got 1 year. I got one season, then I was out to the wing. KV arrived then that second season, to be fair.
Andrew didn't mind. Andrew scored more tries out in the wing, so I don't think he minded. And he was pretty good at making those last-ditch reads on the wing, which we all know that Andrew's famous for, coming off his wing and absolutely emptying people. So, it was great. We had some brilliant times, and I was very lucky that, we were obviously same year group, so we got to know each other a lot. When we travelled and toured together, which I was, roommates and tours. And we've had some of our best days in green and white together, so it's been a good journey.
Yeah, there's been some good times along the way, Chad.
Yeah,
our careers kind of didn't completely they dovetailed actually quite nicely because you came through and we were just discussing when you came into the squad. You came into the squad at the same time as me, and you just kind of took a while to get going. And then by the time you kicked on, it was maybe started 08, 09 season. Whenever you came into the team, was it kind of run?
Yeah. Absolutely, So I, because my first Irish cup then was only 2010, so there wasn't that much of a gap. For me, I was playing a lot number eight, but I was too small for number eight. It was Brian McLaughlin that told me to get the finger out and lose about 6 or 7 kgs and become a seven. Taught me how to get over the ball and ruck, which was my specialty. Keep the ball away from me and just let me hit rucks and tackle things, and it worked out well. And once that changed me, I guess, the open side, I was able to hold my place because there was quite a lot of the competition in the back row at Ulster at that stage. Like when I first came in, there was Roger Wilson, Ian McMillan, Neil Best, pretty quality operators. So for me, I was playing for Ballymena at the time, and just every week there would have been an injury, and I would have thought I might have got my chance. And the next minute, you'd hear in the papers that they flew over someone else from New Zealand or flew over someone else from Australia. So it was frustrating times. And you see, Trimby and Tommy and KV and Marshy, getting a lot of games. And at that time, very frustrating for me. But the patience was worth it. And once I got my run, I was lucky I didn't look back.
Yeah, it was that kind of 2012 year when you really kicked on as a squad, wasn't it? Did you get to the Heineken Cup final that year?
Yeah, we did. That was, I mean, that pack, we had a brilliant team all together, but I think that 2012 Ulster pack was pretty formidable. You know, John Afoa, Rory Best, Tom Court, Dan Toohey, Johan Muller, you know, and then Stevie was still playing too, Big Ferris. So you think of that as your core of your pack. You're going to take any team on in Europe, and I think probably the group, I forget who was in our group of that year, but I know that's the year we beat Munster in 2012, which most of the Ulster players of our sort of age group all say that anyone involved in that day was very special for us, because obviously to win the Thomond is not easy, and we weren't expected to that day. So that was
what do you reckon? Did you have a good balance of age that year, experience and youth, and you know, what was your style of play like? Do you think it was expensive?
Well, certainly we had an unbelievable kick chase. It was kind of Ruan Pienaar kicking the ball and Andrew chasing it. We also had a far better winger on the other side called Craig Gilroy, who started coming on far faster than Andrew, who scored a brilliant try that game. But no, it was the first time where I think as a pack we were Ulster, I guess, over the last few years, we haven't been able to give the backs that somebody with back line. We haven't been able to maybe put a platform that they deserve. But in that year, we certainly did have a pack that were able to bully teams. And then we had Ruan Pienaar, who could, you know, kick goals from anywhere and a bit of magic. So it was a year that we certainly didn't. I mean, we got the final and we were outclassed, without doubt. You know, Leinster that day, I don't think any teams would have beaten them that day. But for us to get there and experience that, even though we lost, it was still a fantastic achievement for myself. Anyway, I still look back on positive memories on that.
And would you have ever holidayed together at the end of season or anything like that, the two of you?
Well, we ended up in Portugal by accident, didn't we?
Yeah.
You were on a golf trip with all your friends. And I was out with I went out with my family to do a bit of, just by chance we bumped into each other. But I don't think you stayed on after any tours, Trimby. You didn't. I was always keen to stay on. You know, in America, you go to Vegas, or, you know, you fly home from New Zealand via Thailand. I think, Andrew, you weren't really.
I was always homesick.
Yeah, straight home. Straight home to Anna.
Yeah. The time in Portugal was, I think we talked about it before, but we were going out there for a bit of kind of chill out time. You were there with your mum, and we went into, because it was getting close to the start of pre-season at that stage, we went down, we were going to do a bit of a gym session. I came down there with my mates one day, and you were down, you had your mom in a plank position. You were doing a core. You were doing some. You were taking her through a circuit. You were like, "Mom, you've got to keep your hips up. You have to keep your hips up. Mom, you're never going to get ripped unless you keep your hips up."
Oh, no, I'm not sure that's 100% true, but
I'll take it. Chris, we actually went on holidays after an Irish tour. We definitely went to San Diego. We might have gone to Vegas. And we almost got arrested, if you remember correctly. It was a Monday night in San Diego. We're drinking in this bar, Trimby. And
just be careful, because Chad's got a normal job.
I have a real job now.
I often forget that. But I remember going, it was Monday night, and it was free or cheap drinks or something like that. So I ordered a vodka Red Bull, and I saw Ian Dowling across the bar. So I picked out some of the ice and I threw a lump of ice and it cracked him in the head. And the barman was like, "What are you doing? You can't do that." And he was like, "He's a friend of mine." And he was like, "Nope, that's it. Get out. And I was like, "Oh no." And I was like trying to drink as many of them as I could while he's dragging me out. So when I got outside, Chris was, I think you'd already been thrown out. So you're outside chatting to this young fella who had this brand new Hummer.
That's right, yeah.
Car. And I was like, "Jesus," we went straight over and this 17-year-old was like, "Yeah, it's my Hummer and all this kind of crack." And we were like, "Can we go for a spin?" And he was there. "Yeah, okay, so jump in." So like six of us piled into the back of this Hummer, sitting on top of each other's laps. And he starts flaking down the road like 150 miles an hour. And sure enough, sirens go on this cop car. It's like a high-speed car chase. Starts chasing us. And your man's panicking that it's not his car. It's actually his cousin's car.
His brother,
wasn't it? Yeah. His brother, yeah. His brother was in the pub. He's like an NFL player or something. And he was in the pub that we were in. And your man was outside watching his car. That's basically what his job is, just stand there and watch it. So the cops pulled us in and got us out onto this. And we were sitting on the sidewalk of this. Remember, it was like a dirty little housing estate because we tried to dodge him. and they were going mental with us.
Well, no, we all had our passports, because obviously you need your passports to buy any drinks. So we give our passports. They also, he saw that they were all Irish, so they were kind of great, because they're Irish, expected. And then, but the one person I remember, it was Stringer was there, if I remember rightly.
Mm, he was.
And he was the only one who, obviously Stringer wouldn't touch any alcohol. So the rest of us were all, you know, still thinking this is funny, laughing, but he was just the fear in Stringer's face going, what is going on here? But no, we all ended up, it was a good story. Luckily, no one arrested.
I think we were actually singing Toto by Africa. Every time the cop would go down to back to his car, we'd all just be like, do, 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 do. And then the flashlight would come back and he'd be like, shut up over there. And Stringer was freaking out.
But you know, the one of the big positives of what's gone on with this pandemic is that our few Twitter account keeps putting back, like, on this day 10 years ago, on this day 6 years ago, and that I'm pretty sure that was after the Churchill Stag in Denver, Colorado. Is that right?
It was actually after the Irish tour of America and Canada.
So we played that tour, and then we went to San Diego, and then we went back. You were too big time at that stage, so you didn't have to play with the Churchill Stags.
I went
from San Diego to Denver and played in that, and we won that. So it was magical. Yeah, brilliant. Yeah. And Andrew, you obviously were far too big. You were probably off for the Lions or something. Or
no, I definitely wasn't for the Lions. I think I was injured.
But all good times.
We've taken over your life story, Trimby. This has been the best part of the story of your life, actually, the story here.
of San Diego.
I wasn't there.
You weren't even there.
You mean like I'm like trying to get involved? Oh, I know that song, Toto. That's my favorite song.
Oh, man.
Well, I suppose fast forward to the 2014 Six Nations, which you won, and the two of you were a key part to that. What are your memories of that?
Well, my memories was just, it was probably the most enjoyable couple of months of my life in a rugby context, because it was the first time where I felt that I was actually playing well enough to hold on to a green jersey. Irish back row, you know, a lot of times I played was always because Sean O'Brien was injured, and Seanie was injured at that stage. But for me, I guess, I was very honest in mind. I knew when I was playing well, I knew when I was playing poorly. At that stage, I knew that I was, you know, doing a job for the team. I think, Andrew, you were out of the scene the year before, wasn't that right? And you'd won Joe back over, so you were long gone.
Yeah,
you were like,
I was dead.
You were dead. Yeah, you were gone, buried. And I was sort of just winning Joe over still. And yeah, look, it was brilliant. It was we had an unbelievable team, you know, at that stage. That game in Paris to win at the end of the tournament.
What are your memories of that day? Like, that was, I remember watching that, and it was one of my favorite Irish games. Thinking back,
yeah,
the day you got the tattoo, Barry.
That's the day I got the tattoo, yeah.
What?
That's how much I enjoyed it.
What tattoo did you get?
I have a massive red 13 on the back of my back.
Brilliant.
Because I bet my mate that O'Driscoll would get man of the match, or Ireland would win or something. It was his last game. So I was like,
yeah.
And I was in Vancouver, and it was like 10 o'clock in the morning. And yeah, look.
Brilliant.
That's not about me again.
Yeah. the team, as I said, going in, look, when you've got someone like Brian Driscoll on your team, you always knew you had a chance. Paris, you know, is always tough, but to finish it like that, they give the big second row, give the wide pass, and it was deemed to be forward, came back. Mm. So you got that ridiculously low moment, high moment, and they won the ball. I think they got a turnover scrum right at the end. We managed to hold them up. There was about six of us in a choke tackle that held them up, and that was the win. And I remember just falling to my knees and just thinking, how have I been here? How am I part of this? Because, I think a lot of players, you kind of, well, my motivation was always, am I going to get caught out? Am I actually good enough to be here? You know, and that was the first run of games where I'd gone, no, actually, you know what? I feel like I'm capable of this, and being around these players. And then that party that night was, or the party for the next couple of weeks was just unreal, and celebrating, cracking night in Paris. I don't know.
Big night in Paris that night.
Yeah, you could say that. Yeah. Jimmy Nesbitt was in, and we had all our family friends in the hotel. I remember just walking through that hotel in the lobby and just you know, hundreds and hundreds of fans made their way across and joined us all for the party. And yeah, they didn't finish early.
Wow. Do you remember Kill Bill 2? Do you know the scene in Kill Bill 2 whenever Uma Thurman punches her way out of being buried alive, and she walks over to get a glass of water from the cafe, and she's kind of like just walking like really straight and really like disheveled? That's the way Chad came in from the night out that night. Because I was down, Anna was getting an early flight back to Belfast in the morning. And the flight was like 6-7 o'clock, whatever it was. And Chad came in, him and Patty, the two of them, just walking in, just like Uma Thurman, just like they'd been buried alive half an hour earlier.
It was a tough shift, yeah.
And I remember, again, so whatever about the game's incredible. And everything you're saying there, I experienced something really similar. I couldn't believe that I was involved in something like that, a bit of history. And it was fitting for you, from your perspective, Chad, that it finished with a choke tackle, because I've never seen a man who loves a choke tackle as much as you. It's like a choke tackle on the final
finish whistle.
I'll take it from here. But the night out, so yeah, so Jimmy Nesbitt was there. He was in great form. And then I just remember one moment whenever we were starting to ramp up for the night out, Chad made the suggestion that it should be lads only and the girls should stay at home.
Terrible. So,
and then Jody Best fell out with him. And I don't know if they've ever made friends since.
Oh, that's amazing. But we all, like,
as soon as we...
I said it, I went, oh, I shouldn't have said that. And then there was like 20 eyes just stare, like evils just look at me. No, no, I was only joking. Like everyone's coming, like it's fine.
As he was saying it, we were all like, that is a solid idea.
I'd love to see all of your faces. Like,
but then as soon as it went, it wasn't well received, then we were all like, Chad, that is ridiculous.
Yeah,
these are our nearest and dearest, our loved ones. Like, you have to bring the girls.
One way, yeah. Nuzzling into their necks. Oh, I love you.
Yeah, but 2014.
Chad. Respect for going.
Thanks, man.
We were talking the other day. Myself, Barry, and Anna actually. We're talking the other day about how you know, you used to do that wellness collection piece in Carton House. You used to have to get up in the morning and say what your sleep score was, what your stress score was, what your mood score was. And me and Hendy had this conversation one time about how my mood score never goes beyond, it's 4, 5, or 6 out of 10. It's never higher, never lower. And Anna always slags me because she says I'm mono, like I'm just so boring. I'm never down, I'm never high, like I'm just always 4, 5, or 6. And it was the perfect illustration. Right. I'd say that day, Anna goes to me, right, well, when's the happiest you've ever been? And honestly, maybe not the happiest, but the most content, the most satisfied I've ever felt is being a part of that. Coming home and then having the team get together at the Four Seasons in Dublin. And just, I walked into the room and all this stuff, like the Four Seasons put on a wee spread and all to kind of commemorate. Congratulations, Andrew, and all. I just sat down and I was like, that is so, so satisfying. Because as you say, both of us were crap for a couple of years before that. And then just finally we got and we were involved. And so everything you're saying there, totally identify with.
There's another reason why, though, you would have loved that night, because there was another theme of your career where literally after it, you know, so anytime you win a big tournament or you have a celebration of some sort, there's always a live band. So live band, as soon as there's a live band, Andrew Trimble goes, live band, I can play the drums. And then he goes, no, don't tell anyone, but I can play the drums. Don't tell anyone. And then it's and Andrew Trimble, can we get you up for a song? And then Trimble would boom, straight up, drums. I mean, obviously, you know, very talented. If you look at the drummer, Buzz, for Hermitage Hill,
he has cameoed already before.
Of course he has. So no, that was... Yeah, every, like, it could be any bar, he would find the live band and straight over and get up there.
Would you get up? We are, like, pull out your own drumsticks and everything.
These that I have. Oh,
yeah,
sure.
Yeah. I did that in 2011 in Queenstown before the World Cup. And then that night, and I've done it a couple other nights as well. I know it's pretty lame. But,
good party trick, to be fair.
Yeah. No, it is.
I mean that. Yeah,
that's cool.
And so off the field then, Chris, like in the gym around the you know, Ulster training sessions, or just
general hanging around, going to coffee shops and everything like that. What was Trimby like for you as a squad?
Fantastic. I mean, like he, I think everyone who's touched Andrew knows that has been touched with Andrew. You'd go down to Irish camp and didn't matter what age you were, didn't matter who you were, Andrew was just such a personal guy, able to have a conversation with him. For me, he's been a great support. You know, any of your bad days, your good days, he's always been there. We celebrated our, we had a 30th birthday dinner together, Trimby, remember that as well. Yeah. No, I think like, he's always going to have his ability to connect with everyone, I think, in a team. Like you go to a rugby club and there's so many different types of personalities. There's very few people that Andrew doesn't get on well with. And that's important. You, if you're spending a lot of time together, you want to take the pitch with someone you want to trust. You need to know that, you know, he's got your back, you've got his back. And that's Andrew. He's loyal, ridiculously honest. And yeah, just a great person that, as you said, to be able to go down and have a coffee with. Feel very lucky to have Trimby as, you know, one of my good friends and rugby teammates. So yeah, I don't know if there's anything else nice I can say about you, Trimby. I phoned another one of Trimby's really good friends, Ian Henderson, right? So I speak to Handy quite a bit still. And I was like, Trimby, or Handy, I've got him going on Baz's show. you know, have you got any, what am I going to do here? Think of these stories. And he goes, oh, the obvious one. I'm like, what? He goes, oh, the David Humphreys parody Twitter account. I went, yeah. So no matter what Andrew's going to be known for us who's known him well, the best thing that Andrew ever contributed to Ulster Rugby was a David Humphreys parody Twitter account. So this was like a secret that went on for months and months and months, and it added so much value and you know, fun to the team. So we, you know, that stage Ulster weren't doing great. And this every day, or every once every week, or twice a week, there was this parody Twitter account that came out, and it was David Humphreys. And some of the tweets that he came out with was just golden. So nobody knew, massive secret. And I was like, who is it? Who is it? So they're going, you know, is it Chris? No, it can't be Chris. He's too stupid. Is it Rory? No way. He's too serious. There's no way. Is it Trimble? And they're like, no way, Trimble. There's no way.
I was
way.
There. Trimble's, I was like, funny. In the corner, I guess.
They're like, there's no way. There's no way that Trimby's funny enough to pull this off, or brave enough. Me, Sir David Humphreys.
Brave enough, I would say.
So, I mean, there was loads, I'm sure Andrew can go into it, but the one that I remember the best was... So Tom Court at the time played a match, and you know, Tom had come to the game late. I'm sure he won't mind me bringing this story up. Struggled in the game, scrummaging, and he just got his contract extended by Dave Humphreys. So the tweet came out, goes, oh, shit, gonna have to rethink Tom Court's contract extension after a scrummaging performance at the weekend. And I mean, like, the place was just like hilarious. Like, so it was ballsy of him, and then eventually, I think. I don't know if David Humphreys, how he found out it was you eventually, Trimby, but did he, I mean, it was you were either suspended, fired, or you had to pay a fee or something, or what?
Yeah, I got fined 2 weeks wages.
Right.
That's amazing. Yeah. So he was really pissed off about it, was he?
He said he wasn't. He said because he was involved, then he couldn't be part of the disciplinary process. But there was this whole formal process with Ulster Rugby. And
how did they find out? Did you have to
They found out towards the board. End. Towards the end, there was an end of season review, an email sent out by David Humphreys. And then it was like, fill out this, or click the link and fill out this form. And then he wrote P.S. At the end, he was like, see you all next season. He said, P.S. We are very close to finding out who at David Humphreys MBE is. Dr. Humphreys MBE it was. So I had
MBE. Amazing. Yeah,
I had reply all. And I said, reply all. I'm talking about. I went on Twitter and then I tweeted and I said, let's get one thing straight. You'll know when I want you to know, right? So he, then at that stage, he knows it was one of like a group of players that he'd send that to. So then I started tweeting. So Shane Logan was the CEO at the time, but he had a background in the military. So we called him G.I. Logan, never to his face, obviously. So I said, G.I. Logan bursts into the office last day of the season. No one goes home until we find out who Dr. Humphreys MBE is. And then in the investigation, the formal process, they said, we'd like to invite you to a Twitter investigation. This is the formal invite I got. And then Shane Logan said, this is actually very, very amusing. I'm quite surprised. So, and then he said, Karen, I can't remember the HR. Yeah. The HR girl. I was like, listen, I'm so sorry. I got started getting flustered and I said, I'm so sorry. This has totally got out of hand. This was only a bit of a laugh. And then Karen goes, well, it may well be a laugh, but you can't go around saying Callum Black is cheap as chips. So, yeah, they said, listen, pay 2 weeks' wages and then we'll leave it at that. So that was it over. But,
That's amazing. God, that is amazing. So any just finally, what about the Will Addison loves ducks? Will we out him here? Does anyone know who that is? Is it a player?
I thought it was Andrew as well. So you're asking the wrong person. I'm always the last to know anything. Like my whole career, things happened. I was always the last to know anything juicy like that. So, I mean, is he still putting posts up?
No, I see much from him, isn't he?
So if he starts up again, then
we'll know.
Yeah, we'll know.
All right. Well, that was a lovely mix of laughs and a little bit of love there as well for Trimby. So thanks a million, man. Really appreciate it, Chris. You're a legend.
No worries, guys. Cheers, thanks for having me on.
Look at this searing pace from Trimble. Oh, he's going to go all the way, is he? Oh, sensational! Trimble, absolutely incredible! From nothing, we saw how dangerous he was in the first half, and that's got to be one of the tries of his career.
Okay, welcome back to part three in Walking Down Memory Lane with Andrew Trimble. Trimby, the things we haven't talked on so far, I'd like to get into a little bit on Joe Schmidt and what influence he had on your career. Then retirement, and then what you've been doing after rugby, including Baz and Andrew's House of Rugby, but also your own company, Kairos. So first of all, Joe Schmidt, when he came in, what kind of state was your career in at that time, and how did he affect it?
So as Chad and I kind of alluded to there a little bit, I don't remember specifically where Chad was. I remember I was struggling a little bit. I never really got much joy with when Kidney was in the job. And I wasn't really playing that well anyway, so I didn't really have much of a case. But probably didn't have an awful lot of confidence at the start, whenever Joe arrived at the start. But whenever I started getting involved in that squad anyway and getting exposure to him and the way he trained guys and the way his sessions went, it was so uncomfortable, so like miserable, and massively put me out of my comfort zone. And I kind of realized what the way I should have been behaving, the way I should have been preparing for to play, and the way I should have been training. And I thought Joe hated me, absolutely hated me at the start. I remember thinking at one stage that training week before the Six Nations, I remember thinking, that's it, this isn't going to work out either. I'm just going to, if there's a way I can retire from Ireland and just play for Ulster, then that'll be a lot less complicated. That's what I wanted to do. Because it was so hard, but also because Joe was riding me. Joe was giving me such a hard time, screaming at me in sessions. And in hindsight, he was getting the best out of me, and it was brilliant for me. And I needed that. It was uncomfortable at the time. But I felt like he gave me a real hard time. In hindsight, I think whenever Joe sees someone who's maybe not fulfilling their potential, or there's a little bit more that he can release or unlock a little bit more potential in someone, I think he maybe saw that in me, and he certainly did that. He was as uncomfortable as that was at the start. He was brilliant for me.
But he would have been hard on everyone, right? It wasn't just you. It would have been across the board.
Yeah, it would have been across the board. But maybe because I was new to the... I was less new. I hadn't been in the autumn camp, to be fair, so I had less exposure to Joe. And then the Leinster guys obviously knew him pretty well. So I just think Joe might have wanted to maybe made a point to me, give me a hard time. Or maybe it wasn't planned. Maybe it just so happened that I was doing stupid stuff in sessions and he was torturing me for it. But I came out and I came home and I said to Anna, this guy hates me even more than Kidney. So it's not looking good. And I remember then I couldn't believe it. I couldn't believe that I got picked for that first game, 2014 against Scotland. Could not believe he selected me. And then the lows and the highs, I always kind of think, if you play professional rugby for long enough, you'll have injuries, non-selection, bad performances, everything. You're kind of confronted with everything when you play rugby full time professionally, and that's a perfect example of the lows and the highs. The lows, me thinking this is not an environment where I'm going to get any joy, and the highs, getting back in the mix and playing Six Nations, and then 8 weeks later winning a Six Nations. Crazy the impact that Joe had on me and my performance levels.
And how did that change then over the course of the next few years? Did he remain hard on you? No, or what?
No, he definitely eased up. He a balance of I started training the correct way, or like doing the sort of stuff that he looked for, the small details that kind of make an impact on the pitch. I started doing that just because I was being trained, and it was kind of that was the outcome of that. Or maybe he started.
How do you mean?
Small stuff like just tagging on a defense, staying upfield and attack whenever you're passing the ball, making good decisions, looking after the ball whenever you carry the ball into contact, really basic stuff. And just stuff like that, really basic stuff for a winger. And whenever he knew then that he could trust me, he maybe kind of took a little bit easier on me. And then at that stage, I started to kind of grow in confidence, and I just knew what he expected. So I was able to deliver a bit better. But yeah, he was brilliant for me. Absolutely brilliant.
Was that year you got Player of the Year, Irish Player of the Year?
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, what a turnaround.
And I remember I came back from that after that Six Nations, I was back playing for Ulster. I remember one game we played against Cardiff, and Cardiff were no great shakes, but and it wasn't a great game or nothing, but I just remember feeling incredible after being coached by Joe Schmidt for 8 weeks, that 8 week block. I just felt like head and shoulders a way better player than I was before. And it's amazing the impact that a coach can have in a short space of time. I almost a little bit like I would have been in school, you know, just the confidence, just carry hard, make good decisions. I just felt really, I don't know, just felt great. Strange feeling.
I suppose what age were you then? You're probably 29, 28, 29, yeah?
I would have been, yeah. Yeah, I'd be, yeah, 30 yeah. maybe. Yeah, 29, 30.
I suppose you have a little bit more of confidence or self-belief, or, you know, it'd be harder to break it at that point, right? You don't take it too personally if someone is having a go off you, or someone is, you're old enough and experienced enough to know that he's just trying to get the best out of me here, and to apply yourself to that, I suppose.
Yeah, exactly. And I think, as I started to get to know Joe, I started to realize that he just, it's a performance. Whenever you're being coached by him, he's performing and he's trying to get the best out of you, and there's nothing personal about it. He's just trying to make sure that he does a really good job as coach, and he prepares everyone as well as possible. It worked really well for me.
And then the last couple of years, I suppose, in Ulster and Ireland, how did you feel your career kind of wound down?
No one ever really finishes in their terms. No one ever really finishes. And if you do finish in your terms, then you wonder, did I have another year in me? You know, so I don't think anyone will ever finish and be really satisfied with what they've done. Having said that, because I'd had that little bit of joy under Joe Schmidt with that 2014 win, and then going to South Africa 2016, then going to Chicago, beat the All Blacks, you know, like a few moments that I was really proud to be involved. Then I had enough joy that I was able to say, right, it didn't go that well. The last year or two didn't go that well, but who cares? Overall, I'm really pleased with what I've achieved. And I threatened to achieve very little until I had that little bit of joy. So I kind of thought, I'm happy with what I've done here. And by that stage, I was 33 and I was keen to move on and do something different anyway.
Okay, well, with that in mind, we've always done our classic movies, classic album, classic game. So let's go classic game with I suppose South Africa and that All Blacks game were the two for me where I would have assumed they would be your two of your greatest achievements in the Irish jersey anyway. And then back to 2014, as you talked about earlier. Have you one game in particular that you think is your favourite match that you've ever played in for Ireland or even Ulster?
Yeah, not to be too predictable about this, and we've kind of already touched on it, but yeah, that France game away in Paris 2014, we'd been blowing teams away really that Six Nations so far, and France hadn't been going that well. We lost at Twickenham, but generally we kind of went to Paris thinking Paris wasn't what it was in the past. It wasn't this really difficult place to go. It wasn't the fortress that it was whenever I was describing whenever Tommy fell over in 2006. It wasn't that anymore. It wasn't Heyman's and Clerk running amok. So we kind of went over there reasonably confident, but France turned up that day and they were really good, to be fair. Huger was tearing it up. Médard's the guy with the sideburns, the 15, wasn't it? Mm-hmm. He was going really well that day. Pascal Pape was going great. Like they really performed at home, and we still did enough to get over the line. And again, a couple of Joe Schmidt plays that were out of the classic Joe Schmidt playbook, you know, that hit the midfield and then sweep back and then that short pass off Murray. Just a couple of things that are just classic kind of signature Joe Schmidt moves. That game was pretty incredible. Anytime you get a win in Paris is pretty incredible. I think we started to take them for granted, but because they played so well and we had to dig so deep, that made that day pretty special.
Wow. Okay, so that trumps the All Blacks.
I think they're both up there, all right. The All Blacks, I think I've done nothing but talk about that.
Fed up of talking about it more so than the French match actually being better.
Yeah, exactly. Just by default, it falls down to the French game.
Own it.
Yeah, I've owned it plenty. Everyone, if I'm sick of talking about it, everybody else is sick of hearing about it.
Yeah, that's true. All right, so favorite film. Let's get to know the real Andrew Trimble.
Oh my goodness.
I Home Alone.
Okay. I'm gonna go for Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves.
Love it.
Yeah. Is it up there with you as well?
Nostalgically, I'm not sure it has aged. It's aged kind of like Braveheart, where it's quite comical, I'd imagine, right now, if you were to watch it back.
Yes, yes.
Spend a lot of it laughing.
Yeah. There's
Alan Rickman's performance is golden.
Brilliant, isn't it? There's so many one-liners in it that have made their way into my life, on a daily basis. If Anna ever asks me where something is and if it's upstairs, I say up the stairs that way,
which I'm sure is a tiny part of that film that no one. That's to remember.
Exactly. Rory Best, to be fair, he's not a massive movie fan, but Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves is his favorite. We would have spent long periods just quoting that back to each other. I thought for a long time Kevin Costner was Brian Adams.
Okay, I can see why you would just as a young, because you're, I suppose, quite young. You'd imagine them together.
I hybrided the music video and the movie. If there's ever a sign for a forest, or anybody ever mentions a forest, Rory and I would turn to each other and say, "Sherwood Forest haunted, sire." And then the other person would say, "Either we take our chances with a ghost, or we become ghosts ourselves."
Serious pussies. They're not worked out at that point that it was just a load of lads up in the trees throwing stones at them.
Right enough. Yeah.
For fuck's sake.
Yeah.
Surely one of them would have escaped and be like, "No, ye clowns." Fucking lunatics in the trees.
Yeah.
All right. So which album then? Which Busted or McFly album were you going with?
What album now? Let's see. My favorite album of all time. And we've reviewed a lot of albums, to be fair, last while. My favorite, it could be Blur, Great Escape, could be Oasis. I'm giving honorable mentions here, and I'm also buying myself time to think about it. Could be a number of Smashing Pumpkins albums. Rage Against the Machine, the first album, could be the one, actually. You know, just sitting as a skinny kind of 13-year-old in your room thinking you're an absolute madman listening to Rage Against the Machine.
Yeah.
And your mom comes in, you're like, "Bullet in your head."
And you were going to church. Oh, sorry, mommy. coming, mommy.
Yeah, for that reason, I'll go with Rage Against the Machine.
Okay, your street cred has just gone back up after your McFly busted intro to the show. So we'll take that. Okay, so then outside of rugby, outside of all that crack, Anna and the kids, obviously it's full time being a dad at home with those three. So how's that going?
Brilliant. The last while has been amazing. I'd say certainly the first 8 weeks of lockdown was brilliant. Weather was class, and we just got back to just being us, having no FOMO. Just this is us, and we're hanging out, and we're having the crack, and we're just enjoying each other's our time together. And the kids, after the first couple of weeks, Jack and Molly especially, Katie's starting to get into the mix now and shake things up a little bit. Katie's on her feet, and she just run around like grabbing Molly by the hair, and she just wants a bit of attention, which is nice because she's been getting bullied for a long time, and now she's fighting back,
getting her all back.
Yeah, but after Jack and Molly, after a couple of weeks, those two getting used to each other, then they've been getting on brilliantly as well. So, love and life. And this is a bit of a turning point for us now. Anna's going back to work next week. Katie and Molly are going into nursery, and I'm looking after Jack a day a week. So it's all a bit of a change up now. So I think we're kind of pleased that we've had this time together, and it's been great. And Anna, obviously, I met Anna when I was young, and she was even younger. She was 16. She was 16 and I was 19, and we were kind of friends for a long time, and then got married, kids, and everybody kind of just gets on with life and the busyness of life. But we're really happy. Hopefully no more kids. Please.
go again for the crack.
No, I can't do it. I haven't got the heart for it. Great setup.
You're the tightest unit I know, man. So I'm sure you'll make that decision together. Be the right one. And she's way funnier than you as well, I must say.
Absolutely.
Trimby often, I'd ring him up and it'll be the two of them on the phone. So I end up having a three-way with Trimby and his missus over a video call, which was very enjoyable. So.
That happens quite a bit. Niall O'Connor, who I'd be good mates with as well, lives in New York now, but did the rounds. He was at Ulster a couple of times. He would have been around our house loads, and to the point where I was kind of like, you know, you call at someone's house when you're a kid and you go, oh, can Andrew come out to play? It was if I had been in that context, it would have been, hey, Andrew, is Anna there? So then him and Anna would have been just sitting chatting in the kitchen for hours, and I'd have been watching TV. That's the way I got. Yeah. So I feel like people are using me to get
down. She's a legend.
Yeah.
And come here, outside of rugby then. Outside of the house of rugby, we've got Kairos, your own business. So tell us a little bit about that and how's it going?
Yeah, so my exposure to Joe Schmidt's kind of training environment made me realize the benefit of being really prepared, really organized. And then I realized one difficulty in getting organized in a team environment is the team communication, because there's WhatsApps, whiteboards, emails, PDFs, written S&C programs. It can be a little bit chaotic, and I think that hampers players' performance, and it also makes, you know, pain the hole for other staff members. So we created Kairos to manage medical appointments initially, as just an app for the players to use to book in, and now we've extended it to manage like training sessions, numbers to sessions, requirements, session plans, travel schedules, all that kind of stuff. So it's been a really amazing experience the last couple of years, getting a bit of investment, building a team of developers, and learning something that I didn't know anything about. Mm. And it's been a great experience. I've partnered with a guy called Gareth Quinn in Belfast, who's very, very switched on, and he keeps me right. And it's been great. Munster are starting to use Kairos this week. Ulster been using it for a while. Worcester or another are starting to use it in the coming weeks, and then we're chatting to a couple of football teams as well. So we're starting to get a bit of traction, and we'll see where that takes us.
Brilliant. That's great, man. So you're not obviously in the IT nerdy side, you're sales pitch and giving your side of the story as a former player.
I wish I had whenever I was, because I studied loads. I did a theology and then I did a management postgrad and then I did a finance postgrad. I wish I'd spent some time learning how to code or design something. It's only like, and how typical is that? Whenever, like, it's always older people saying to people when they're playing, you should be studying, and even me fine-tuning that. I should have studied something more useful maybe. But I wish I was hands-on. I wish I could kind of be more creative with tech. But anyway, the guys we have are incredible. They're brilliant. And they're very sound as well, which is unusual for design or tech engineers. It's a good wee team. There's five of us, and everybody gets on great. So all good.
Brilliant. Yeah, mm-hmm. Well, I know that's very important to you, because you're having the crack is probably the most important thing that I think my observation of your character, your personality, is over the last two seasons that we've done this, and probably since I've gotten to know you from playing and stuff, was always having a laugh and first to have a joke. And it's been a pleasure being your pal over the last couple of years. You're an absolute legend. And I can't wait to see where this takes us, what we'll do next, and where your career goes from here on. So I fucking love you, man.
I love you too, Barry.
It's all about you.
A bullet in the head.
All right. Look, that is Andrew Trimble's life to date. But now, look, he's present, he's here, and the world is his oyster. Go spread your wings, Trimby. Be the man we all know you can be, and just be happy. All right?
That's lovely. The bar is very, very high for next week. I'm going to get started working on that straight away after we finish this.
No, you won't. We never do any work for this till like a few hours beforehand. So be grand.
Yeah, brilliant. Thanks for putting in so much effort. And thanks to Chad for coming on and taking us down memory lane.
Yeah. Thanks to Pat and to Paul and to Dermot, to Anthony for putting this show together, and for all your research on Trimby as well. So yeah, we'll be back next week to talk about me, which will be weird. Be a bit weird. All right, Trimby, it's been a pleasure. Thank you very much for sharing all that stuff with us.
Nice one, Shalom. Thanks for having me.
I don't know. All right, this has been Baz and Andrew's House of Rugby here on Joe Together with Guinness. Party on.
Party on.
It's all about... No, what was the other one?
Bullet in the head.
No, the... Been to the year 3000.
3000.
Not much is... Is it?
Well, because the year 2000's already been.
Yeah, it's 3000.
Oh, yeah, that's what I said, 3000.
Oh, yeah. I said 3 as well.
Not much has changed, but they live on the water. And your great-great-great-granddaughter.
It's pretty fine.
It's pretty fine.
It's pretty fine. Oh, that's pathetic.
It's such a shame that you're a good singer and I've just ruined that for you.
No, it makes it better.
You were listening to Baz and Andrew's House of Rugby on Joe, together with Guinness. Drink responsibly. Visit drinkaware.ie for the facts.